Well, let's open up our Bibles to the 8th chapter of the book of Daniel. I know some of this will not make maybe a great deal of sense to those of you that have been in other classes. Today we've combined a little bit. But nevertheless, we do believe there will be food for thought even for you in our study. I've often said that whenever one examines the book of Daniel, he is looking at world history in outline. Because God in the book of Daniel is telling what's going to transpire between the days of Daniel and the setting up of the kingdom of Jesus Christ. The 8th chapter is really supplementary to the 7th chapter. The vision that we have of Daniel here in the 8th chapter is a period of the overall symbolism that we had back there in chapter 7. Really, today's lesson has to do with things that will take place in the kingdom of Greece and the combined kingdoms of Media and Persia. So this is supplementary to what we had back in chapter 7. We have a little horn in this chapter, exactly like we did back in chapter 7. But the little horn in the 8th chapter is the Antichrist of the Old Testament, Antiochus Epiphanes. Whereas the Antichrist in the 7th chapter is the final Antichrist in the time of the revival of the Roman Empire. So we want to get into our lesson. In verse 1 and 2, we have the setting of the vision. And you're going to see here that this one took place before the events in chapter 5, as was true of chapter 7. Though you do have a 2-year period of time between chapter 7 and chapter 8, as indicated in the very first verse. In the 3rd year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. That is, the one that he had the first year of Belshazzar in chapter 7. So in verse 1, essentially, we are told the time of this vision. Chronologically, it would have been something like 551 B.C., please bear in mind these dates are only approximate because historians are not agreed. Like I said, there's only 2-year time has elapsed here between chapter 7 and chapter 8. But chapter 7 and chapter 8 all happened before chapter 5. I want you to keep that chronology in mind. It's important. So in verse 1, we are told the time of the vision. And in verse 2, we are told the place of the vision. Where was he? Most of the time before, he has been in Babylon. But this time, he's in Shushan, some distance away from Babylon. You say, well, why is he over there? I don't know. Was he transported over there by the Holy Spirit? Or was he over there in Shushan on business for Belshazzar the king? Well, what was the circumstance? I'm not sure. Anyway, that's where the vision took place. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Eulea. So there's not a great deal told us here other than what I have put in primarily from history. Now, whether Daniel is merely there in the spirit or there in the body, we might contest. I gather that he's probably there in the body from the way it reads to me. But anyway, he's in a city that's almost 230 miles east of Babylon. And it's 120 miles north of what we call today the Persian Gulf, where all the trouble seems to take place in the Middle East. It had earlier been the capital of Elam, a very prominent city back before the days of Daniel there. It is now, though, just an important eastern city, for Babylon is a prominent city of the world at this time. But sometime after this, it's going to become the capital of Persia under Cyrus. That's the time spoken of in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 1, verse 1, and also in the book of Esther, chapter 1. So What I'm telling you is it was once a great city. It's now just a common city. It's going to become a prominent city again in the future. And that's a little rundown there on it. Now, it had other names in history. This river did, this Ulai, or Ulai, has to do with how you want to accent the word. Ulai sometimes is what we usually call it. It's called a river here. It was a river, but actually it was a man-made river. Where I grew up, man-made rivers were very common. Our section was very wet. And when we had large rains in the spring, it made agriculture almost impossible. So the farmers got together and they dug canals. A very prominent canal in the valleys along where I live was the Mantachie Canal. And that's what it was, a canal. It was dug to flow into the Tumbigbee River. It was, I assume, a river of a long standing in our section. But that's what this was. It was a dug canal. It really did not run right through the city of Shushan, unless it might have at some earlier time, but it was near the northeast of the city. And I suppose was dug for the purpose of agriculture, like the canal that I spoke of. All the details, I'm not sure, but it's called here a river. It was a man-made river, and nevertheless was a river. Do not misunderstand me. So he is in Shushan, he is near the river Ulai. And that's about all we can be certain of as to the time and place. The time and place is not nearly so important as the actual vision that he saw, divinely wrought by God. So that's what we have as we go down to verse 3, on down to verse 8. We have the vision of the ram and the he-goat. It's a very significant vision because it describes developments in the kingdoms of Midian, Persia, as they encounter the kingdom of Greece that is rising to power in the world. I almost should have told you to go get a world history book down, go get the Encyclopedia Britannica or the World Book or the Americana, or even just a good world history book, something like Wells' Outlines in History or the like, and read about the kingdoms of Media and Persia, as well as Greece. And this lesson would make a great deal more sense. Maybe when you go home today, you'll have time, since it's bad you can't get out and do much else, and maybe TV won't be very good, and you'll have time to get down to the encyclopedia and sit down and read a little bit about Alexander and read something about Cyrus the Persian and the like, and you'll understand the lesson better if you can. Because about all I can do in this class is just briefly tell you the facts of history. And then he gives the vision there in verse 3, like I said. Then I lift up my eyes, as if what he's looking toward heaven, toward God. That's the one the vision's coming from. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. That's not an extraordinary creature. That's a creature that looked like you would expect it to look like. Now, the beasts back in chapter 7, some of them were extraordinary creatures. Some of them were nondescript beasts. At least the last beast was the fourth beast. But a ram that has two horns is nothing unusual. That was a normal sight, even in the days of Daniel. However, he's going to see a rather unusual characteristics later here, but that's a normal thing so far. It's a ram that had two horns. Well, nothing unusual about that, just a normal occurrence. And the two horns were high. They were a little bit long, a little above average, I'd say. But one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. Now, the details of history that's spelled out in that are almost unbelievable. Especially due to the fact that it was all written when Babylon was the mistress of the world, before Media and Persia came into being, and before there were ever a kingdom of Greece, such as existed under Alexander the Great. But nevertheless, the details of history they're almost unbelievable when you think about what's said there. Well, let's look now at this ram that has the two horns. In verse 20, we are told that the ram symbolizes the kings of Media and Persia. So we can't argue with that. The Bible gives its own interpretation. That settles the matter. That is what it means. Now let's think about, though, the symbolism there of a ram for the kingdom of Media and Persia. The Persian ruler bore the head of a ram as he stood at the head of his army. Fact of history. Now, what was the symbolism that Daniel used to represent that kingdom even before it came into being? The symbol of the kingdom itself, the ram. Also, you had the figure of a ram on the coins that were in Persia. You had a ram's head. Now, all this is written, bear in mind, after Daniel's prophecy. It all happened after he wrote this. And then the remarkable thing is that out of the two horns, one of them was higher than the other. But the highest horn came out last. Well, that's a remarkable thing because let's go back now to the former visions. We had in the second chapter the vision of the metallic man. And you had the right arm being Persia and the left arm being Media, Persia being the stronger of the two. Well, in the chapter before, chapter 7, you had the bear. And the bear was lifted up on one side. Again, showing that the kingdom of Persia was dominant over the kingdom of Media. But now the significant thing here is that the very chronology of this event is stated there. But one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. You see, from history, the kingdom of Media, when they first combined forces, was the greatest kingdom. It was the greater of the two. But it wasn't long until Persia asserted itself and became by far superior to that of Media. In other words, it gained the ascendancy. But that happened at a later time and not at the beginning. So Daniel's prophecy is so detailed here until he says that Media will be as great as Persia, but in the end, Persia will be greater than Media. So if I did not believe that the Bible was the Word of God, and I believe that the book of Daniel was written at the time that I said at the beginning here, I would have to say that this book foretold the facts of history in a remarkable manner, almost unbelievable. Do you see why the pseudo-Daniel has to be invented by the liberal scholars? This is just too true to the facts for man to have written unless he is inspired of God. So they have to say that Daniel wrote after it happened and not before. But the truth of the matter is that he wrote it in Babylon. As a matter of fact, he died just as the kingdom of Media and Persia was coming to power. So he certainly could not have known about Belshazzar. I mean, he could have known here about Belshazzar, but he could have known nothing about Alexander. Because he died before Alexander the Great ever came on the scene. No, there's no pseudo-Daniel. This is God making known outlines of world history. Now look at the movement of the ram as we go down to verse 4. We find something about the conquest of the kingdom. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward. So that no beast might stand before him. There are other beasts here, but they cannot stand before the ram. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. He was invincible, all conquering. But he did according to his will and became great. Now again, let's look there for a few moments at the movement of this ram. It, of course, is describing the political conquest of the kingdoms of Media and Persia. Media and Persia's conquest, just like Daniel said, started out going to the west. And then they moved to the north and then to the south. You say, well, what about the east? Very little conquest toward the east. No significant conquest whatsoever, even according to the facts of history. Now let's spell it out more in detail. The conquest of Cyrus and his successors were mainly to the west. Babylon, that was one of his first centers of attack. That's what he did when he overthrew the kingdom of Babylon in the days of Belshazzar. Babylon, Mesopotamia, Syria, and Asia Minor, including Greece. And Greece will retaliate. That's also in this lesson. Then he went northward to Kokish, Armenia, Iberia, and the dwellers of the Caspian Sea area. And then southward, Judea, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Libya. Now these are all facts that are well attested in history books. But Daniel said it all happened years and years before it ever took place. World history in outline. Okay, now let's note some other facts there. There was none able to deliver out of his hands. That implies other animals. Nations rose up. Babylon rose up against him. The Egyptians rose up against him. The Ethiopians rose up against him. But they couldn't defeat Cyrus. Those two kingdoms were stronger than all the kingdoms they attacked. So they conquered them. They overthrew these kingdoms. There was nobody that could deliver out of their hands. And then it says, became great. That's the great power of Persia under Cyrus and his successors. There was at least a time in the world when the kingdom of Persia with the weaker kingdom of Media was the greatest kingdom in the world in that day. And so well, Daniel attests that when he said it became great. The kingdom became great. But, you know, there's always somebody that wants to destroy the great and wants to be greater. That's the depravity of man's heart. Whatever one man can do, there's somebody else that'll come along, and somehow, some way, he gets the idea that he can do even better. And in some cases, he does. That's what happened here. Because it was hardly a world conqueror like Alexander. I've always admired a lot of things about him. A lot of things I didn't like, but I admire his military strategy. I wish sometime we had him back here to engage in the various wars this country seems to get involved in. At least we could win if we had a man that knew how to fight like he did. So sometimes I wonder about our leaders in that respect, just how much military genius they may have. And so Daniel's still in the vision now. He's going to see a he-goat come on the scene. And as I was considering, that is, this movement of the ram, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Now this goat's unusual. Ordinarily goats have two horns. This one just has one. So this is not some normal creature that he's seeing here. Though everything about it is normal except it has the one horn. You say, well, somebody must have dehorned the other one. No, not necessarily. It just originally had the one horn. You say, well, it looked like a unicorn then. Well, I suppose that it did look something like a unicorn, so far as that's concerned. So, actually, in the Hebrew, it's a buck of the goats. That's what it's called, a buck of the goats. And verse 21 makes it very plain that this is the king of Greece. It is none other than Alexander the Great, the son of Philip of Macedon. That's the ones under consideration here. Now, the kingdom itself is used interchangeably there. At times, the horn seems to be Alexander, and in the main, it is Alexander. But at times, the kingdom itself is the whole kingdom of Greece. But really, Alexander was the kingdom of Greece when you think about it. Pretty hard to divorce him from the kingdom of Greece. He was like Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. He was all the kingdom. He was like de Gaulle in France. He was the kingdom. And when he died over there, there was great unrest and still is in France because a mighty strong man passed off the scene. And so that's what's going to be true here. Sometimes Alexander's the horn, sometimes he's the kingdom. Actually, they're all together, they're part of the same. And sometimes the horn refers to the man. And we'll see that as we go along. So what we're seeing here then is the conquest of Alexander against the kingdoms of Media and Persia. Now the national emblem of Greece was a goat. It was found on their coins. Their capital city was called Aegea, which means goat city. It was located adjacent to a sea called Aegean, or the Goat Sea. A son of Alexander by Roxana, his wife, was called Aegeus, or a son of a goat. That was a national emblem. Now bear in mind that Daniel is using that national emblem hundreds of years before the kingdom came into being. Now if you don't believe that's inspiration, then account for it otherwise. That is indeed the inspiration of God. And what's remarkable is he not only foretold that there would be this kingdom of Greece and this great king, this great horn, but that he would come from the west. Now what direction is Greece from Medo-Persia? It's west. He'll come from the west. That is, come against the kingdoms of Median Persia. So that too is very significant there, I would say. Anybody that has looked at the map knows that Greece is west of Persia. What is Persia? It's what you call today Iran, where old Ayatollah Khomeini, the madman, is. In 1935, the name of Persia was changed to Iran. It's the same country, though. Sometime it was called Mesopotamian by other names there in the Bible. Now, just for a few brief facts about the campaign of Alexander, I want you to note how that he said there that he went on the face of the whole earth and he didn't even touch the ground. That's great speed, you know. And a fellow can jump a long way when he doesn't touch the ground, right? Well, he's speaking about the great speed with which Alexander conquered the world. When you think about what he did in about 12 years, it's almost unbelievable. He conquered the known world of his day. A young man in his 20s and early 30s conquered all the world. Not only did he conquer all the world, but he whipped armies that had three or four times the men that he had. And yet Daniel foretold all of that years and years before it ever took place. Now just a brief rundown here of history. Alexander leaped the Hellespont in 334 B.C. with an army of 30,000 infantry and 5,000 cavalry. He defeated a Persian force on the bank of the Granicus. And then by a swift advance eastward, he in the following year, 333 B.C., defeated at Issus a Persian army of 60,000 men. He's almost outnumbered there 2-1. And he won. Commanded by the Persian king, Darius III. After minor conquest in Phoenicia and Egypt, he returned to Syria, where on the banks of the Tigris, he defeated an army of 1 million men led by Darius. Now, when you think about that, the first thought I have is, how could this young whippersnapper with a small force whip all of these other people? Bear in mind that the kingdom of Median Persia was awkward. The bear has strength, but it's awkward. Well, there was one thing that was known about the kingdom of Greece. It was like a leopard. It had speed. It moved, and it got the job done. That, of course, we saw back in chapter 7. So now the he-goat is going to attack the ram. And that's what we see there as we go down to verse 6. We've really already gotten into some of that, but we're going to read it now. And he came to the ram that had two horns, one horn against two, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran upon him in the fury of his power. Characteristic of Alexander was his great military power. He knew how to fight. He knew how to win. He knew how to get the victory. So the goat draws near to the ram as they're getting ready for combat. That's what Daniel sees there. With about 35,000 troops, Alexander crossed the Hellespont, thereby coming immediately into Persian territory. Not far away was the Granicus River, which he found necessary to cross, and where a large Persian force awaited him. That very battle is foretold there in verse 6 of Daniel 8. Then we go on down to verse 7. And I saw him come close to the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him. And there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hands. That is a complete demolishment of the kingdoms of Media and Persia by Alexander. That's certainly what's foretold there. So Daniel not only saw the ram knocked to the ground, but he saw the he-goat trample upon the ram, literally destroy the particles that of the animal that would have been left. Now this is the wrath of Greece against the Persians for the invasion of their land in former days. You ought to go back and read what the Persians did to the Greeks when they entered their country. You'll understand why that when Alexander came down there to get even with them, he didn't spare them very much. There was reasons for that from the political standpoint. The cruelties that the Greeks suffered under the invasion of the Persians was phenomenal. And there was certainly a retaliation here under Alexander. I can imagine that they said, "Now we're going to give you a dose of what you gave us." And they did just that. In 331, Alexander defeated Darius, Commodus, and in 330 B.C., he completed his conquest of Persia. He stamped upon the kingdom. Mighty Persia could not stand before the small army of Alexander the Great. That's a military strategy that the world still is amazed at. How that this man was so few, so inexperienced to some degree, could go out and win all these battles like he did. It was the hand of God. That's all you can say. It was the hand of God in providence. There's no other explanation, because the world has no understanding of it except to know that it took place. And so we go on then to note some events that take place after that. He tells about how that there's going to be this division in the kingdom and all of that as we go on down here into verse 8. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. That's the fourfold division of the kingdom of Greece upon the death of Alexander at either the age of 32 or 33. The historians can't agree on that, and so I don't know that I can settle the matter for him. The he-goat became greater than the ram. That's certainly true of Alexander. But he died just as he had completed his subjugation of all Medo-Persia. That's what God said he would do. On returning to Babylon from the east, he was taken with swamp fever. He got drunk while he was sick in order to try to relieve the pain, no doubt. And in June 323 B.C., he died at the age either of 32 or 33. Historians are not agreed. A very young man when he died. He was younger than I am when he died. That's something for me to think about. He had four generals, and they divided the kingdom among themselves. There were minor conflicts, but no major conflict, so far as I recall. Now, the four generals were Gassander. He took Macedonia, Thessaly, Greece, and the western division. And then there was Lysimachus that took Thrace, Cappadocia, and much of Asia Minor. That was the northern division. There was Seleucus that took Syria, Babylonia, Media. That was the eastern part. Ptolemy took Egypt, Cyrus, Cyprus, and, of course, the southern part of the kingdom of Greece. Now, there would be a division in the third kingdom before the rise of the fourth kingdom. That's clearly stated here. In other words, there would be this division in Greece before the Romans come on the scene. Now, this emergency of the little horn we must quickly look at as we go down to verse 9 and 10 and complete our lesson. Here is the Antichrist of the Old Testament. And what this man did to the Jews in the days of his reign is what the final Antichrist will do to him again on a larger scale. That's why we call him the Antichrist of the Old Testament. A lot of people say Antiochus Epiphanes was the only Antichrist in the book of Daniel. That's where they're mistaken. They're sadly mistaken, as we'll see later in this book. Now let's look there at this emergency of the little horn. And this little horn is coming up in a very special place. And out of one of them, these four divisions, bear in mind that Syria was one of these divisions, Egypt was another, Thrace, Cappadocia and the like, Macedonia, these were all divisions of it. And out of one of them came forth a little horn. This is a little horn out of a bigger horn at first, which waxed exceeding great. It became even bigger than the horn that it came out of. Toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. I believe the pleasant land is Daniel's way of speaking of the land of Palestine. The Holy Land, as we call it. So now let's take a few moments there to look at the rise of Antiochus Epiphanes. He was the eighth king in the Syrian dynasty. And he reigned from 175 to 164 B.C. And of that chronology, we can almost be sure. That's pretty definite. All scholars are pretty well agreed on those dates, as far as I can tell. Now, all of the horns that Daniel saw grow on the he-goat grew contrary to nature. First of all, a goat ordinarily does not have just the one horn, and then he doesn't have four after that. And certainly he doesn't have another horn then coming out of one of the horns on the top of his head. That's what he saw. This is prophetic symbolism. So the one horn came out of the fourth. In other words, this little horn comes out of the Syrian kingdom, where Seleucus originally was the general that took it over. Now the little horn in chapter 7 is Antichrist, but he exists in the revival of the Roman Empire. This little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes, and he existed during the time of the fourfold division of the Grecian Empire. So they're not appearing at the same time. You see, there's hundreds of years between these events. So there's no reason why anybody should mistake Antiochus Epiphanes with the final Antichrist, because he is a historical character of the past. The Antichrist, it will be a historical character of the future. They are similar, but they're not the same. Again, the details is almost unbelievable. Toward the south, Antiochus fought against Ptolemy Philometor and the kingdom of Egypt. Egypt, of course, is to the south of Syria. And east, and that would be those that sought to change the government in Persia. He made a campaign into Mesopotamia, particularly into Armenia, called today modern Turkey. The glorious land, and of course that's another way to translate that. It's called here in our version the pleasant land. It can be translated the pleasant land or the glorious land. I put down the glorious land here because that is perhaps a more apt translation, because in this land is where you had the Shekinah glory of God, especially during the time of the greatness of the kingdom and all of that. So this is Palestine. So then what we're reading of here is a campaign of Antiochus Epiphanes against the Jewish people in Jerusalem, in the land of Palestine. The most devastating campaign that was. This is, of course, Palestine and Jerusalem. If you read those proof texts, you'll begin to see there what I'm talking about. Now, Alexander, of course, he attacked Egypt and various other places. But also, the king of Syria is going to attack Egypt. That's the first thing he did. He declared war on Egypt to the south. And as he came back from that campaign to the south, he said, well, I'll plunder the land of Palestine on the way back home to Syria that's north of Palestine. And so on his return from Egypt, he killed 80,000 people of the nation of Israel. That's men of war that were being killed. Women and children included too. He sold 40,000 of the people into slavery. And if you begin to think about that, you can understand why the Maccabean revolt broke out against Antiochus Epiphanes, because these Jews had enough. They said, we're going to get him. And they did get him to some degree. However, he got quite a few of them in the meantime. There's a statement then about this little horn that is almost hard to reconcile in verse 10 there. And it waxed great, the little horn, in Antiochus Epiphanes, even to the host of heaven, or against the host of heaven, we could translate. And it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. That's certainly an abnormal sight. For a horn to cast down the stars of heaven, that has to be prophetic symbolism. The idea is that God is going to allow Antiochus to prevail against the Jewish people. You say, well, how in the world are they called stars? Well, it's not unusual in the Bible. If you want to read there in Jeremiah, and you want to read there a number of times in the book of Genesis, a number of times, the stars represent the Jewish people. In Joseph's dream and all that, you had the stars, the tribes there doing obeisance before him and all of that. So stars in the Bible represent God's people, even in the New Testament. Revelation 1:20, the stars are the pastors of the churches. So stars represent God's people. Here in this context, it's the Jewish people, the Hebrews and all of that. So Antiochus will oppress God's people in their land. Not out of their land, in their land. So where then will the Jews be when the Antichrist oppresses them? Back in their land, like they are today. So Antiochus would oppress God's people in their land. He would put large numbers to death that would try to resist his unfair regulations. And the main what he wanted to do, he wanted to make all the Jews into Greeks. He wanted them to speak the Greek language and all of this. And there was a violent revolt against him called the Maccabean Revolt. And they said, we just simply will not tolerate the oppression of our people that Antiochus is heaping upon us. Of course, he's going to offer a sow on the altar, and that's going to be pretty obnoxious to the Jews of that day. Well, we'll stop right there. I hope you remember a few facts, though, about this man, Alexander the Great. He was a man that died at the age of 33 of swamp fever and in a drunken stupor. And it's said from history that he hung his head and cried because he had no more worlds to conquer. Well, he had conquered the known world. There was one remarkable thing about him. He gave orders that when he would be buried, that his hands would be outside the coffin. Tell all of the generals and all the soldiers that all of his greatness he didn't take with him in his death. So the man had at least some respect to divinity of some sort. It's a great lesson. A lot of people today might ought to be buried with their hands out of the coffin, because that says that of all of his greatness, he took none of it with him into the world of the hereafter. Remarkable man in that respect. Well, that'll do it. You can stretch, relax a moment for the next service.